Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland.
Hi everybody, Claire here from Witches of Scotland, bringing a bonus episode for International Women's Day. We held a sell-out event with Sarah Sheridan, author of the brilliant book Where Are the Women. This book was in part inspiration for the Witches of Scotland campaign. For everyone who unfortunately couldn't get a ticket, here is now the audio of the event. We're also going to post links to YouTube so that you can watch it as well. We want to thank everyone who came along and listened to us, and we also want to thank Sarah Sheridan for coming along and speaking to us. Happy International Women's Day.
Can I just start off then by saying hello and welcome to everybody that's come along to today's event. We are absolutely shocked that we managed to get a sold out event of 500 people. It's really quite flabbergasting. I think that's mostly down to the fact that Claire just tweeted for her life for about 14 hours. It's quite remarkable. I was looking at it going, good God, it's like a marathoner. But it's really great to have everybody here. And we're delighted that we're hoping that this signals that you would be in support of what we're doing with the campaign. So thanks for coming. So I'm Zoe Venditozzi. Claire, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. I am I am advocate. I work in criminal law, and I started off the campaign on International Women's Day last year. And along with Zoe Venditozzi since that time, we are the Witches of Scotland.
Yes, although not actually witches. No. I said that to somebody today, we're not actually witches. Well, that's fine if you are, but we're not witches. But we are joined today by our first guest, which is Sarah Sheridan. And it's an absolute joy to have you here today, Sarah. Hello.
Thank you. Hello, hello.
So Sarah is a writer of many, many books, fiction and non-fiction, but it was particularly your non-fiction book, obviously, Sarah, Where Are All the Women, that kind of kicked things off, wasn't it, Claire?
Yes. If I can just let you know where the campaign idea started from, I suppose that's the best place to start. And one of the reasons that we have asked Sarah here today is that it was the reading of her book, Where Are the Women, that I read and I was entranced by, because it reimagines a Scotland where the people are remembered are women and not men. So the streets are named after women, the statues are named after women, and it was a really transformative book. And I'm delighted to say that two lucky people today will be getting a signed hard copy of that. Sarah has donated two signed hard copies, so she's chosen various numbers. We are going to pick those people and we're going to give away the book and the finest traditions at the end, and we'll nominate who those people are and give them to them. But what happened was, I work in an area of law dealing with miscarriages of justice, so I kind of filter the world through that way. And I had been always interested in Scottish history and very much interested in the history of witch trials in Scotland. But I was kind of thinking about it from a jurisprudential theory, as opposed to thinking about really the people themselves, the women themselves involved in these events. And I had this sort of idea in the background, and I had been researching what one of our former Lord Advocates, who was called the Bloody Mackenzie. And that Lord Advocate didn't actually believe that all of the witch trials were real witches. And what he did was he went around trying to shut down quite a lot of these witch trials. And I was reading about him and I came across a woman who he recorded when she was being tortured by the people trying to get a confession out of her. And they said, can you be a witch and not know it? And I was sitting in the faculty library and I was almost in tears when I heard that. The idea that this woman was so bewildered, so beleaguered, so lost in her own faith in herself, that she actually thought, well, maybe I am a witch, maybe these people know better than me. And I was very distressed about it. So a short time later, I was in Princes Street Gardens walking my dogs, and I was looking around, and I must have had Sarah's book in my mind. Because I was looking at all the statues in Princes Street Gardens, and I saw men on horseback, and I saw lots of names of men on statues. And I thought, where are the women? There is not one woman, one named woman in this place at all. If an alien was to come down right now and look around, they wouldn't see any women. There's no visibility of women in public spaces. And to top it all, I got to the top of Princes Street Gardens and saw there was a full-size statue of a named bear. I was like, there's a bear. There's an actual named bear who did very good things during the war. Granted, he did good things. I'm not taking it away from the bear. But there was a bear, and there was also a dog called the unfortunate name of Bum the dog. And I thought, I looked over from where I was standing next to Wojciech the bear, and I looked over at the Castle Esplanade and just below it at Nor Loch. And at the Castle Esplanade, at least 300 women, that's a conservative estimate, were killed as witches. And I thought, not only is history not recording these women, we're recording women who do great things. We're not putting women up in statues. We're not putting women in plinths. Not only are they not doing that, but they're not even recording when terrible things happen to women. There is nothing to say that we're sorry for the fact 300 women were killed at this spot. There is a thing called the Witch's Well, but if you read it, the Witch's Well says 300 people were killed here, 300 women were killed here. Some used their gifts for good and some for bad. So it's not an acknowledgement, nothing at all. So at that, I stomped home and I wrote down the Witches of Scotland and said, I want a pardon for these women. I want an apology, because many of them died before they ever got to court. And I want a national memorial. I want something which shows that 4,000 people's lives were ruined by an accusation of witchcraft, that 2,500 paid with their lives, and 84% of these, higher than the rest of Europe, 84% of these were women. And that is when the campaign started. So
how long ago was that, Claire, that you had that moment?
That happened in 2019, but it took me quite a while to set things up. And it wasn't until International Women's Day last year that we kicked off the event. Zoe, you were there too.
I was there, yeah. So Claire and I met at a social engagement, if you remember those things from the past. And that must have been the summer preceding, like in 2019, it must have been. And Claire said to me that she had this idea then, and that we'd sort of bonded over an enjoyment of true crime podcasts. And she asked me if I was interested in working on this with her. So then fast forward a wee bit, and Claire did all the work and put it all together, first of all. And then we launched a year ago today in a brewery in Dundee. And we'll talk about that maybe a wee bit more later, why we chose a brewery. But it was at that point that it was launched. And as Claire has made the joke a few times, if we actually had any sort of psychic ability or magic ability, we'd be able to foretell that we'd launch it. And then a few weeks later, we'd have to unlaunch it, or at least put it on hold for a good wee while because of lockdown. But then we started to record the podcast in about, was it September, Claire?
Yeah.
Of 2020. So that's, for those of you that have been following sort of from the early days, that's when we first launched them. And then that brings us on to our first guest, which of course was Sarah. So Sarah, yeah. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about Where Are the Women, a bit more than what Claire's already said?
Not really. I think you've summed it up pretty well, actually. I mean, I got the opportunity to do this, and Where the Women is based on a project by a feminist called Rebecca Solnit, who in the New Yorker magazine remapped the New York subway according to women's history. And that's really where I got the idea, and had been knocking about some Historic Environment Scotland properties. Because I'd been part of a short story book that had been commissioned by Historic Environment Scotland. And so was talking to the publisher, giving him a hard time, saying, well, you don't have enough women, because I've always been writing about women. You haven't got enough women in women's history in these properties. And he said, what do you want to do? And we discussed this project that he had seen as well, and basically got super ambitious and decided to do the whole country. And I think this must have, you know, this was beginning of 2018, finished it at the end of 2018, came out in 2019, and then met Claire about 6 months later, maybe 7 months later, something like that. And you'd already read it, which is always amazing. And so we could have this chat about, you know, the witches' monuments that do exist, because there are a few witches' monuments around Scotland, but they're pretty haphazard in different places. And it's not all the witches. It's only a witch from a particular place or one particular story. So, I mean, the witches, for me, I was also running at that time a perfume company called Reek, and we had a perfume that memorialised the witches. So I'd kind of been memorialising witches myself, which the idea was you would be able to spray on this perfume and you would become a memorial.
I love that idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. So we did that for about 4 years. I did that. We had a Jacobite perfume and we had a witch's perfume, and we were about to do a pirate queen's perfume, because we have some amazing female pirates as well. Brexit kind of happened and various other things happened, and we decided we weren't going to do that anymore. So
Sarah, can you tell us about why you wrote the book? I think it's a great story of your realization of Where Are the Women. Can you tell us about how that came about?
I mean, it'd been a very long time, because I had been working in women's history and spending a lot of time in the archive. I'm basically a great big swot, and I'm not an academic historian. I'm a novelist. I make stuff up. So for me, I kept finding these little tantalising glimpses into women's lives mostly from the late Georgian, early Victorian era. That's the era that I had mostly up until that point written about. And I would just get pulled into their stories and think, why is so much missing? And then in 2016, there were various studies done, including one by a TV historian called Bethany Hughes, who you might have seen, who specializes in the classical era. But she was asked by Historic England to do a study of resources, historical resources. And she came up with this figure that only 0.5% of our historical resources are female. And when I saw that, I thought, yeah, that really chimes with not only artifact stores that I've been in, but also archives. And it's just not good enough. And so what would it be like if we did memorialize women? And this sort of very confrontational idea, really, of imagining it before it happens, because if you can't imagine it, you can't do it. And so the idea was that we would hold a glass. Actually, the book was, my hope was that it would hold a glass up to the way that our built environment and our rural landscape is memorialized, which is all the men and very, very few of the women. And as you say, we do have some female statues in Edinburgh. We have three, I think, or four in central Edinburgh. They're all royal. We have three Marys and one Victoria, I think, in central Edinburgh. We get this feel that, you know, you just don't see women achieving stuff, exactly what you said. And I thought about, I suppose, the difference that would have made to me as a kid, as a young woman, and the difference that I want to make for my daughter, my goddaughters, my nieces, and actually the boys as well, because the view of history that we have is really skewed. What we see in sort of traditional history isn't what really happened. If you go back into the archive and you look at all different kinds of eras, women were achieving things, and they were doing so in an integrated way with the men. It's just that we don't record it in the same way, and we don't hold that record. So every time somebody does something, it has to be the first. And so there was this record of women's achievement, but then also a record to some degree of victimhood. We have a lot of monuments all over Europe, all over everywhere, to male victimhood, to war heroes, we call them. And we don't memorialise women in that way. And so groups of women like the witches or the women who were raped after the 45 uprising in Scotland, we have quite a few of those groups of female victims, if you like, which, as you say, there's just nothing to them. And it seemed wrong to me, it just seemed wrong. So once you started to imagine it, you become very radicalised. I was always an equality activist. I was always a feminist. By the time I'd finished writing this book, I was absolutely raging. Because you realise as you walk down the street, actually, that is another man, and that's another man, and that bench is a man as well. And you end up sort of muttering to yourself as you walk down George Street in Edinburgh, this is totally ridiculous. What is going on? And not another statue of David Livingstone and John Knox. You know, I've just kind of had enough of it. So, yeah, that's kind of where the book came from for me.
That was a point that I wanted to bring up that Claire and I talked about, which is obviously we're in the month of International Women's History Month, and tomorrow's International Women's Day, which is why we've organised this today to tie in with that. Why, to answer some of the questions that we've had occasionally, particularly through Twitter, why is there any relevance to looking at these women of the past? Why can we not just move on? It's in the past. Who cares? You know, it's happened. What's the point of this? What would you say to that?
My answer would be it's very difficult to go where you want to go without understanding where you came from. And our general understanding of history and the way that it's taught right throughout our education system and even handed down within families is not really an accurate representation of what was going on. So we're not really getting to the grips with where we come from. And if we don't know where we come from, how can we understand where we go? And I spent quite a bit of time in the last 10 years on and off in Germany. And it's really interesting because they process history in Germany in a completely different way, particularly their 20th century history. So you have the Cold War, but you also have the sort of the fascist era. And they're very good at looking their history in the eye. And we don't do that in Scotland nor in the UK and actually in lots of other places in Europe. And the witches is sort of certainly part of that for us here in Scotland. And I think it chimes, the witches particularly chime with people because I think that idea of not being able to escape, not being able to get away is very traumatic. And it's something that many women seem to identify with. And that may be because in some senses, some of that witchy behaviour, some of that women being run down and not being able to escape and being accused of things, it still goes on online, it still goes on. We live in a very patriarchal culture. You only have to look at the newspapers really any day of the week and you will see stories that sort of chime with the witches. So I think the reason the witches chime with so many people is that it is really something that happened in our history, it is over, it is past, but some of that culture still exists for us.
And were you yourself taught anything at school about the Scottish witches? Because this is something that Claire and I have talked about with various people on the podcast.
I don't think so. I mean, I remember doing old grade history and higher history because I'm that old that those were the exams. And we did William Pitt and we did a little bit about, I mean, we really didn't do anything much about women at all. And if we did anything about women, it was royal women. So a little bit about Queen Anne or whatever, but that, you know, that was kind of it. So no, not I didn't at all. And actually going into it wasn't the archive where I first realized that I was missing a whole bit of history. It was in the artifact stores. So I have a strong sort of background in artifacts. My father was an antiques dealer. And when you're writing a novel, you write, you know, to bring that past alive, you need to be quite experiential. So I would go in and try on a bodice. I would try and ride side saddle. I would and discover all this stuff and think these women, everyone was living like this, everyone was feeling this, everyone was smelling this or tasting this or whatever. So yeah, that bringing women's lives alive like that made me realize that I hadn't been taught the history that goes with that.
Yeah, and I was taught sheep farming and how to leave a piece of land fallow, which was great use to me in Govan Hill where I grew up, obviously.
History.
That's what we sort of said, well, there were the Highland clearances and some people were moved off their land, but anyway, sheep were moved on and let's talk about the sheep. And I'm so angry that I've been disconnected with my history. And after a while, of course, when you become an adult, it's your own fault for not going back and looking at these sorts of things. But it does, we do laugh, but the question is, why don't we know about it? I mean, it's International Women's History Month. Sorry, I'm mixing up my days. It's International Women's Day tomorrow, but it's Women's History Month. And all throughout Scotland, people are confounded and amazed when they find out that so many women were killed as witches.
I mean, I had no notion at all of really what happened until we started in the podcast, and we started to get on different experts in different fields who were saying, well, this is how that worked. You know, for example, we had Julian Goodair on, who's seen, I think, as one of like the absolute foremost historians about the witch trials, amongst other things, but he really knows about the witch trials. That was fascinating to me because I knew nothing at all. Now, I'm from Fife. And there was a lot of issues with witch trials in Fife, a lot of witches or accused witches. And I knew nothing about it at all, really nothing. So that to me has been really fascinating. But also because there are some things that we have as myth in our culture about the witches, that it's been good to know, actually, well, that's not really true, but that part is true. So like things about in Scotland, I'm talking about things about, you know, witches being ducked in water and that sort of thing, and how the witches were killed. And we've got this idea that they were burned at the stake. So to discover that they were actually strangled, which we've had slightly different versions on that. So I've had one historian being in touch saying that that meant garrotted, and another historian being in touch this week saying that that just meant hanged. So learning, you know, as gruesome as that is, to learn the sort of the nuts and bolts of how those things happened. And then the bodies were burned so that not only had they been executed, but they were just absolutely removed, that these women and men were just absolutely done away with. It has been absolutely shocking and fascinating. You've got to be honest, you know, it's really interesting. The stories are really interesting, but to not have known that at all is quite shocking to me.
I think there's something about how we are taught history around, you know, you are taught an era, so you might get taught about 20 years or 30 years or 50 years of history. And I think certainly when I started to write Where Are the Women, it was the first time I had looked at things overall, because the book runs from women who are folk myths, you know, the Caliach, the Hag of Spring, right up to, they had to be dead. Historic environment's rule was anyone you write about has to be dead. But there were women who died, you know, shortly before I was writing the book. So 20th century women, really. And seeing the connections. And I think with the witches, something that certainly has struck me, and that I've learned actually from the podcast, the listening from the podcast, it's not a fact, it's an extrapolation, that this didn't just affect the women who were killed or their families who were alive then, that this is something that has stayed with us. And you know about your grandmother, even if your grandmother died before you were born, and you're told that story. And so for women to be told that story about their grandmothers or their great aunt or somebody in the village or somebody in the town, must have a kind of an effect, a sort of post-traumatic effect of, you know, if you are a woman and you are accused, you don't necessarily get away with it, because most of them didn't. That you know you can be victimized in that way. And I think, you know, very much in the way the Irish famine is still alive in Irish culture, I think that the witches are very much still alive to some degree in Scottish culture. And given that, it's really quite extraordinary that within the broad sweep of our history, there are so many women who tried to stand up for their rights. So we have amazing women campaigning for education, women's tertiary education, for suffragettes, for the suffrage. And these are a couple of hundred years after the witches, but they come from that tradition, they know those stories. So I think that's really interesting.
I think that's a really interesting point about the trauma. As a teacher, you know, like I can see sort of the impact sometimes, sadly, of generational trauma. And I just don't think that there can possibly be, you know, that we've escaped scot-free, as it were, from that terrible thing that happened going down from each generation, you know. And Claire and I have discovered through talking to different people and through research that, you know, that people were often, if they weren't executed, if they got away with it, that they might have been banished, you know, so they actually had to move completely somewhere else. There was one woman we read about who was branded. So she's branded on the face. so that she would just always be known as this person that had been accused of witchcraft, not found guilty of it, or it was a lesser version of it. But that would mean that that would then carry on the shame of their children or extra family, and would just keep carrying down. So I think it's fascinating from that point of view as well. That's sort of part of our reasoning here, is that we need to make peace with the past to an extent. And of course, we alive people didn't cause it, obviously. That's not the point of it. But the point is that we see this was a bad thing that happened, and we want to make sure that we recognise that so that we can move forward.
Yeah, I also think there's so much there's so much that we really have to think about. And sorry, people keep coming up, people, who is Claire? I am Claire. It says Madison on my name. That's my name as well. I'm Madison Claire Mitchell. So hi, everyone. Some people call me Mad, Madge, Maggie. My name is Claire too. So, but I think that's really, really important to think about Scotland as a whole, because some things that I thought about or we were taught about by Julian Goodyear when he spoke to us was Scotland at the time this happened only had about 1 million people in it. So for 4,000 people to be accused of witchcraft, and that is a conservative estimate as the people that we know, there were many, many people who were accused of witchcraft that will never have been recorded, unfortunately, and extrajudicial killings of usually women that were killed because of witchcraft. So if there was only 1 million people in Scotland, and Professor Goodyear said that in order to have one case of a woman being found guilty as a witch, there needed to be an infrastructure of about 100 people, from the judges to the inspectors to the church elders to the people that built the pyres to the people that held them in custody. There is no one that wouldn't have known about a witchcraft trial in Scotland at that time, or not known someone, or had someone in their family. And although it affected 4,000 people, it affected practically 4,000 people. The practical effect of that fear in women for 200 years that they could at any point be accused of a witch and be burnt alive is something which I think must have had a broader effect than just the people we think about. So it's really everyone in Scotland, and I include that as Maine as well. So even when I think about the 4,000 people and just bringing it down to numbers, those 4,000 people, the very worst happened for them. But for everyone else, there was that constant fear. And that must have some effect on your psyche. I see people reading in the chat that DNA, trauma is kept in the DNA and that's inherited. And I know people are doing investigations in that regard. I think that's important. And I think one of the other things that's important, and particularly with an emphasis on International Women's Day, what we've got to remember is that the reason that women were targeted, and again, it's the experts that have told us this, was that women were seen as weaker morally, intellectually. They were the weaker sex, and therefore they were more susceptible to the devil. We go right the way back to the story of Eve. She was the one who was in the Garden of Eden. I can't go much further than that because my Old Testament's not too good, so I'm not going to take that analogy much further. But we go right back to the idea of women being the weaker sex, and that is the underlying reason. John Knox said, and I'm not sure which right way around this is, but John Knox says, women are the port and the gate of the devil. That was the view. It was women because women were weaker. And that's the underlying misogynistic idea. And very recently, in fact, on a podcast coming out, the podcast that's just out, in fact, we spoke to Hazel, the daughter of Jeanette Archibald, who wrote a great play called The Devil's Mark, and which there are links to on the socials that you can find. And she speaks to women through the generations. She has generations of 17th, 18th century women, modern women, suffragettes, talking to one another about their experience of women. And it really got me thinking that we really still do live in a patriarchy, and we are not yet equal. Until those things are sorted out, then we should go back, look at the past, find out what is wrong with that, and make a determination to go on in a better way.
I've just got something recently.
Sorry,
to hear it.
Yes.
I've discovered, I've been reading, because I'm not a medievalist, I've never been a medievalist, but I had to write about some medieval women for the book, and I got kind of interested in it. And there's this period sort of in the late 13th century, around 1260, 1270, where things just change globally for women. And the church decides that women who have prior to that point been considered possible to for women to have ordination, not in the modern sense of ordination, but for women to be deaconesses in the church, for there to be women bishops, for there to be female popes, all of that just disappears at that point. And that's when this sort of slightly misogynistic thing comes in. And it seems to be global, because then I read a book about women's status in Japan, and it's exactly the same era that they start to take legal rights from women and shift the way that women can hold property, for example, shift the way that marriage law, divorce law and things are dealt with. So there does seem to be a really big shift during that sort of late part of the 13th century, which is, you know, prior to our witches campaign in Scotland. But it demoted women in the public eye. Culturally, women just suddenly weren't considered. It was just like a rise in misogyny, really. And I think that's really interesting. I'm digging out more about it now, and looking particularly actually at stuff within the church, because it seems to have happened very much in Western Europe as a kind of church initiative.
I know that we have not one but two statues of John Knox. Is that correct? Sarah told me about John Knox.
Yeah, should we talk about him a little bit?
Yeah,
but John Knox's part in this whole situation.
Yeah, it is thought that John Knox was the author of the Witchcraft Act. This is the thinking behind it. Julian Goodyear has written a paper on it, which is freely available that people can read. If you put in John Knox, Julian Goodyear, and the Witchcraft Act, that paper should come up. It's one of these ones that's been made available publicly, and he does a very good forensic test picking apart the other possible people who wrote it, and basically it's like a whodunit, leaving only John Knox left. And so that's why he is in part, of course, relevant to the Witches of Scotland campaign. But no doubt you can tell us much more, Sarah.
It was a pretty extreme sort of Reformation rebel, actually radical, at the beginning of his career, preached at St Giles in Edinburgh. I think the interesting thing, though, with regard to the witches was that when Mary Queen of Scots left Scotland, and the church or Scottish state, which kind of was the same thing or very closely connected anyway at that point, got hold of James VI, who was the architect of the very first set of witchcraft trials, and he became James VI, who at this point is a very young child, Mary's son. John Knox is key to setting up James's education. And he dies when James is, I think, 6 or 7, 8, something like that, you know, less certainly under 10. John Knox is around for that very original formation. John Knox's famous book, which is a diatribe really against women, particularly against Catholic women, particularly against queens, is very telling. And if you think this is the guy who was in charge of James's education, ratting out James's mother, his primary caregiver, the woman who gave him everything, who gave him his entitlement to the crown, in fact, it kind of casts, I think, a little bit of light. We can use a little bit of modern psychology maybe to understand that Knox's influence continued very long after he had in fact died. So yeah, he was pretty rabid, and if you start to read some of his speeches, which are available, you can buy books of them and stuff, it feels, you know, quite often when you read stuff from history, it feels shocking, but it feels particularly shocking, I think, now, and when you realise what it ultimately kind of led to.
I very much hope he spoke, Sarah, didn't he, about the monstrous regiment of women.
Yes, the first blast of his book is called The First Blast of the Trumpet Against This Monstrous Regiment of Women, by whom he means Catholic queens. He's really got it in for Mary, but nonetheless, you know, it's pretty... Well,
I would absolutely like to repurpose that and call us a monstrous regiment of women who will try and get a pardon for these women, because his statue still stands in Edinburgh today at the old part of the university, is it? I'm not quite sure how you would describe it, but I'm really keen to ensure that there's a much, much bigger monument
to all the women that suffered as a result of what happened, and as a result of that underlying view that women just aren't as good as men. I mean, people say, well, that was the prevailing view then. It wasn't right then. It's not right now.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, he was a radical. He had been banned. Mary had tried to kill him. You know. So you've got to understand there's a lot of big personalities there when you're but he really took it into a kind of whole ethos, and you know, if you're looking at misogyny in the Church of Scotland, John Knox is a great place to start, and the legacy of John Knox tumbles down to some of the vocabulary I think even today.
I mean, the reasons for women and the men as well, because we have to always remember that there were 15% of the people that were accused and executed were men too. And I always feel I'm really very much a feminist, but I just feel, for the sake of accuracy, I just need to mention that just now. But it wasn't always just straightforward why women were accused, was it? We've had various reasons for it, and we've got this sort of modern myth just now, and that Claire and I have talked about and have asked people about. And I'll start maybe with that question, which is, if you were around then, do you think that you would have been accused as a witch? Right? We asked that question, I think, on Twitter, and had thousands of women getting literally thousands of women getting in touch saying, oh, definitely, definitely I would have been. And the reasons were very broad. They were from being a redhead to having a disability, to being mouthy, to being educated, to, you know, to being a lesbian, to having sort of health issues. They were really, really broad. But there's a lot of women that take it in an interesting way, I think, psychologically, as a sort of a badge of honour. That you think that you would have been, you know, held as being somebody that needed to be, you know, literally executed. What do you think of that, ladies, women?
Well, for my part in researching it, what we actually find really, really sadly is that it didn't actually take anything at all for a woman to be accused of being a witch. So it's nice that we look back and think, feisty, strong women. And sometimes, of course, if you were a woman who would call out the local church for not doing right things, then you would make yourself a more likely target. That is true. But in fact, for the most part, you really didn't need to do anything at all to be called a witch. And that is, again, the terror of it. And as I say, the 200 years of fear that people would have been in. So it's nice to look back and imbue all the people with that strength. But sometimes, a lot of the time, these were, as the Orkney Memorial says, they were just folk.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's really important to us during the campaign, is that we'd each week, if you've not listened to the podcast, we name three witches or groups of witches, and have their names and have as much as we've got of their story from the different research tools that we've got. And we think it's really important because we need to think of them as people, as just ordinary people that were just going about their lives, whatever those lives might have been, and that sort of sometimes out of nowhere they were accused and then went through this horrible experience. So to us, it's really, really important that we humanize as far as we can, because the records inevitably are kind of scant in some places. Like one week we did some witches, and they were referred to, I think, Claire, as sundry witches. And that's all the information about them. Sundry witches. Or was it sundry witches or women, Claire?
No, it was sundry witches. That's right.
Yeah. Witches, I mean, it's not even a number, you know, it's just absolutely crazy that. So it's very important to us that we humanize them. And some of the different reasons that we've read, we've come across, or the experts have told us about for them being accused could range from them, from people wanting to get their land. So it was to get what they had. So we had a story recently where it was a son-in-law accused his mother-in-law of being a witch so that he could get her land, which is a neat trick, I think, if you can pull that one off. But there was lots of other things. You know, there's famous stories about people that had limb differences, what we'd call now limb differences, or people like, for example, Lilias Aidey in Fife, who we've talked about quite extensively, because there's good records for that. So we know quite a lot about the story. She seemed to be accused because she was just a bit different and maybe a bit odd. She was very tall. you know, there's speculation that she was sort of 6 foot tall because they'd had her, some of her bones that they could measure. And she was just a little bit of an outsider, you know, so it could be just really quite mild. And of course, Claire, if we talk from a legal point of view, what sort of evidence was needed for a conviction?
Evidence that was needed was statements taken from people. That just meant that someone would go around and take statements. I've seen statements of people saying that they were out late at night. That was one of the reasons. That they were near a place where a fire had later taken place. One which particularly upset me, they were seen talking to their cat, someone who talks to their pets all the time. very, very minor things. Importantly, of course, during this period of time, women were not allowed to be witnesses in their own right. So I actually have a record which is found in a book by Larner, who publishes this, which is the then most senior lawyer in Scotland going into court and saying, except in exceptional cases, women, of course, can't be witnesses in their own right. So they were arguing they couldn't be witnesses. So you'd be a woman watching this happening to you, yet have no voice in yourself in the criminal justice system. So that was really what the trial process was like. And you were, of course, judged as you would have been simply by a number of men. The largest number of people we've seen for being commissioners or investigators was 23 people investigating the one woman for witchcraft and repeatedly interviewing her.
I think as well, it's not always like there is this sense where we tend to think that they're people who are a bit different or a bit of an outsider. And that's certainly true. That would draw attention to you and maybe help people to point the finger at you. But actually, there's a number of kind of upper class women who get accused of witchcraft, which kind of surprises me, because particularly during the medieval, you know, if you were upper class, if you were of the ruling class, you were kind of a bit untouchable. But that wasn't the case with the witchcraft trials, and there are a number of sort of upper class women who did get accused and got convicted. They tended to have a slightly better rate of getting off because they could take their case to the High Court and they could get a lawyer. And so instead of almost certainly, if you were just tried in the Kirk, you know, by your local community people, you are probably going to get found guilty. But if you were in the High Court, you might have more like a 50-50 chance of getting off. But it isn't the case that you had to be an outsider. You might have been an outsider or you might not. You just have to kind of, the spotlight just falls on you. And that's what's terrifying about it in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that sort of atmosphere of fear, you know, that anybody could get accused, you know, and you mentioned you sort of upper class people. I live near Dundee, and that's one of the things that Claire and I, before we went into lockdown or between lockdowns, or at some point when we were actually allowed out of the house, I forget when, we went and had a look at the place that marks Gristle Jaffrey in Dundee. So she was a witch of Dundee, and apparently she was, I think, was she a merchant's wife? Mm-hmm. She was quite, you know, quite well to do. And it was people in the Kirk that were involved with that as well. But it's quite shocking to think that just basically, as Claire says, anybody could just say, you're a witch and you would just need to tell a story. And some of the stories we've read are interesting, to say the least, about what was witnessed, about people's conduct with the devil and how that looked. And you can see that these kind of stories obviously just passed around, and then that became, well, this is the way that the devil sort of de-baptizes you or unbaptizes you. And the stories are really, they're colourful, I would say, some of the things we've read, aren't they, Claire?
Yeah, I think colourful is a wild understatement.
Yeah,
they are amazing, and you touched on it earlier, Zoe, which is that I think it's fair enough that we're interested in these, that they actually interest us and fascinate us in the same way, because although we have to separate the truth of what happened to these women, the stories are still very interesting, and they tell us different things about our society. So I don't think there's any problem in acknowledging the two and acknowledging that it's really, really interesting, but we should just make sure that we remember that at the bottom of these there were really horrific stories of
real people,
torture and death. Yeah.
Now, just, we've only got about 10 minutes left, so I'm just wondering if we should talk a little bit about why it is specifically we're asking for a pardon and an apology, if there's a track record with that in Scotland, and what's possible to happen with those
Okay, well, I can see we can extend it just a wee bit longer because of the length of time that we had with letting people in. But yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose let's start with what relevance it has. People say, well, why do you want to do this? It's 300 or 400 years old, you know, 400 years old, who cares about what happens then? And hopefully we've been able to go some way to address those reasons as to why we think it's important. It's just still absolutely relevant to the modern day. And if I need any proof of that, only this morning and The Observer have started a campaign against femicide, a campaign against women killing men. And I'm obliged to somebody who tweeted me that this morning. But in advance of knowing that I was going to be speaking to you guys today, I went on the Scottish news website, and of they have a wee banner down the side that says 10 different stories that you can click on. And of those 10 different stories, 4 of them were about violence coming to women. And that is just daily. If you look at those things, you just see those sorts of things daily. So we still live in a society which is dominated by stories of women coming to violence. And we still fear. There was a very, very interesting thing on Twitter where someone said, my boyfriend didn't realise that I was scared when I walked down the street at night, or I put my keys in my pocket to hold on to them just in case there's someone coming up behind me. And it's that fear that still doesn't go away. And I think we really need to speak about that. So that's a further part of it. I suppose, and the last thing is that the last reason I think of the relevance is if we do not know our history and all the good work that Sarah has done bringing these women back to us again, if we don't know our history, we are bound to repeat it. And not to be too bleak on the subject, but there's a great article in Vanity Fair with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Margaret Atwood. And Margaret Atwood wrote The Handmaid's Tale inspired by the story of the witches of Massachusetts, in particular a woman called Half-Hung Mary. And if you find her poem on that, that's amazing. Sorry, my dogs are kicking off in the background as usual.
You've got strong opinions, Claire.
Both my dogs are feminists. And but she wrote the book about, she wrote the book of The Handmaid's Tale based on the stories of the women who were witches in Massachusetts. And she said she was always amazed when people described it as a dystopian future, The Handmaid's Tale was talking about, because she said, this is not a future, it's a past. I've just taken the experience of women during the witchcraft trials. And there was a conversation between her at an event that she went to when she and Ruth Bader Ginsburg met and spoke to one another. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, you know, I don't see women having these same problems again, because women have got into positions of power, and when women get into positions of power, they won't let bad things happen to women again. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, I'm not so sure about that. And Zoe, I think she gave a very good example of in the modern day what type of women are called witches.
Yeah, I mean, the use of the word witch is still very current. You know, there, give you a really good example. Claire tweeted lots of people on Friday, and one of those people was our First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, and she tweeted that she wasn't able to come but encouraged people to come along to it. And there was about 200 or so the last time I looked responses, and a great deal of them were very negative, and that's going to happen with politicians, obviously. But the use of the word witch was quite frequent. There was talking about another politician, a female politician, if she was going to be in attendance, that this person would come along to watch her getting tarred and feathered. There was lots of use of, you know, oh, you'll fit in with that coven, you know, all the rest of it. So the word and the imagery around witches is still used frequently to shut women down. And I occasionally do a search in Twitter to see about what's happening with the word witch in different instances. And it's definitely used frequently to shut women down. You know, I think that's really interesting and is really worth having a look at. I think we're going through a kind of a strange time just now with the way that some women have relationships with each other on social media. I think there's a lot of an issue about why women have to often be anonymous on social media. You know, there are lots of things that we need to be really upfront and talk about in a grown up and sensible way. So I think that this issue about, you know, people falling on other people, we need to talk about that and be quite kind of upfront about it. So I think that's partly why it's relevant as well just now. Another thing that's interesting is people send us articles a lot. And one of the articles somebody sent me recently was, I think, from Scientific American. And it was about a community, I believe, in India. And what I'll do is I'll find this and we'll put it up so people can read the article for themselves and put it on our socials. And it was about how the use of accusing somebody of being a witch is still used effectively in some countries to get people's land or to take away their agency. And then there's women that are then again dispossessed and disempowered. And that's because this word is being used, because it's still got this, you know, frightening connotation. So I think it's really important in Scotland that we recognise that and say, you know, this is not the way for us to treat each other as civilised modern people, you know.
So tell us, Zoe, what is it the Witches of Scotland want?
We want an apology, we want a pardon, and we want a national monument, a memorial to the people that were accused and executed as witches.
And a few people have said, a few people have asked us about a pardon and said, but doesn't a pardon mean that you're accepting that they were guilty?
Can you explain the legal position on that, please?
Yeah, well, insofar as I can. when I looked into what I could try to do for women, we cannot appeal their convictions anymore. There are no people that have what's described as legitimate interest in this, although I, of course, believe we do all have a legitimate interest, but not as the law would see it. And in any event, we can't just try and appeal one conviction at a time. It would just never work. It would never, ever happen. We could never, ever get it to court. But what we can do is we ask for a pardon. And one of the things, again, in the background that I was thinking about when I saw the pardon for men that were convicted of homosexual offences, and much more recently minors, was the wording of what the Scottish Parliament said. And the wording was in fact put in our petition, but it was taken out because the tyranny of the word count meant that we couldn't have it all in to show you. But the wording of the pardon in respect of homosexual men made it clear that what these people had done was something that should not have been a crime, and they were not pardoning them. They were not pardoning them because they'd committed a crime, but what they were saying was it should never have been a crime, and that's why they were granting the pardon. And the wording in phraseology that was applicable to homosexual offences can simply be transferred and lifted onto the people that were accused of witchcraft. Also, more recently, minors are being granted a pardon for the involvement in protests in the 1980s. And the pardon is being made collectively and posthumously for those that are no longer with us. And that's what we want at Witches of Scotland. We want a pardon for those that were convicted. We want an apology for those who weren't convicted, but for whatever reason were accused and their life were ruined by it. You can only get a pardon for those that were convicted. So we want a pardon, we want an apology, and last of all, we want a national memorial. And I think we've already had lots of chats. People are really, really interested about national memorials and what would a national memorial look like. And one of the most inspired, I think, ideas so far was the one that I read about in your book, Sarah.
So I created, I think in Perthshire, a witch's trail, which you can follow down to a real burnt out church, a wrecked church, which is owned by Historic Environment Scotland. It's part of their property portfolio, so it's doable. And this church inside has, it's a smell monument, because I'm a smelly feminist, that's what it is. So you walk into this burnt out church and it smells of charring, which of course is really evocative of the witches, but also you line the walls with different herbs, and I have a whole list of herbs actually in the book that I used. I consulted a brilliant perfumer called Alex Musgrave to help me create something that would really just be, I suppose the smelly ghost of those women. And so the idea is you can follow that trail right down, go to the burnt out church and walk through, and it will have an amazing atmosphere because it is a burnt out church. Most of the women were tried in the Kirk sessions. Not as many women as people think were actually herbalists or some kind of healers. But I think the idea of that strikes very much with the modern consciousness of what it is to be a witch. And of course, some people do self-identify as witches now in a totally different kind of way. So that seemed to me something that was really fitting. But I think there are lots of different ways to do that monument. I like the idea of something in Edinburgh because it's our capital city. I'm not quite sure exactly what the monument should be, but I mean, that's a great conversation for later, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we've got, if you haven't already, the petition is up on the Scottish Parliament website. And I know I bang on about this, but it would be really great to get as many people as possible to sign it, because it does show there's an appetite then for people to look at the issue. And we know that it's not just ourselves in Scotland. There's lots of different community groups that are involved in it and are working hard to get the image of the witches kind of rehabilitated and to shine a light on what's happening with it. But also, we've recently been contacted by a group in Catalonia. Claire, do you want to talk about that a wee bit? With the Sapiens people?
Sapiens of Catalonia, the leading cultural and history magazine in Catalonia, contacted us about a month ago and said that they had been inspired by our campaign and were starting the campaign called, They Were Not Witches, They Were Women. And we have a hashtag which we use, which if you're going to be tweeting about this, and we would encourage you to use your socials to let everyone know to sign the petition, we tweet hashtag women not witches. But they get in contact with us and they said that in part we had inspired them to their own campaign. And a couple of days ago, or yesterday, we appeared live at a screen, an outdoor screening in over there, talking about the Witches of Scotland campaign, and they have got a petition started themselves, the Witches of Catalonia, and they at the start got 150 professors of history, their history magazine, so obviously got a lot of interest, and 150 professors kicked this off to sign it, and they have already had an overwhelming amount of people sign it. They've already had about 7,500, where we are 1,700. But they have a bit more ability and a bit more reach than us financially as well. They had a glossy magazine that's out this month with a good subscription, in which we have Zoe and I are interviewed for it, and they have a snazzy video and stuff like that. But I would ask that without the funding, obviously, that we've got, as Zoe says, let's this monstrous regiment of women all get together, let's women talk to other women, as we're good at doing, and saying, have you signed this yet, because it would be really fantastic to show the Scottish Parliament that we believe that women's history in Scotland should be properly recorded, and those people should be given their place and restored to our history as the women that they were, and not witches. And of course, in seeing women, I'm also recognising that 15% men were convicted as well.
Yeah.
So on that, I wonder if we might, because we're just about to finish up, I wonder if we might do two things. First of all, hopefully with the appliance of science. Well, secondly, what we will play out with a poem that we commissioned for the launch of the petition some weeks ago. And I should mention that we've only got until 10 days left of the petition. It's up until the 17th of March. So if it's St. Patrick's Day and you're celebrating, that's the last day. It might be the 16th actually that it's down on. So please do try and sign before then. But we're going to play out shortly with a poem by Lenny Soris online, a young poet who herself has come in for a lot of social media pylon and criticism for no other reason than teaching people a Scottish word of the day. And she has had so much abuse for no reason at all. But if you don't know her already, follow her. She's got some great poems. But just before we do that, two things. First of all, I will explain who has won Sarah Sheridan's
book, the winners of that. And secondly, we will hear briefly from Julia Campanelli, who will tell us a wee bit about what's happening with her and the event that's on tomorrow, which is not sold out. So it's another opportunity to hear from groups, this time in particular the Paisley group, about what they're doing. But I just want to say to Evelyn Hardy and Catherine Barrington, you are the winners of this fantastic hardback copy, Where Are the Women, signed. And please do get in contact with us in the chat just now or by emailing us afterwards and letting us know your address, and we will send those out to you. And Catherine's saying, wow, thank you. Catherine, I'm wondering if you live, and Evelyn too, fantastic. I'm glad we've contacted both people. So that's great. Just get in contact with us either by direct message or by emailing us or some such on the socials, and we will get your address and have those sent out to you. I wonder, Julia, would you be available to have a word with us? Julia is a actor, a writer, a producer, a director, and she has written a script, which she will tell you about briefly, and she's actually going to be performing some of that script tomorrow. I cannot keep up with the number of awards it has won, and we are really, really keen to see her. Julia, are you here? Can you speak to us?
I am, Claire. Thank you for having me on, and congratulations on your 1 year anniversary of the launch of your campaign. I think it's wonderful what you're doing. Claire and I met, and Zoe, we met online. We have a common cause in the exoneration of people accused of witchcraft. I, as she said, I'm in the film industry, and I live in New York, and I became acquainted with the Paisley Witches. The name of my screenplay is The Paisley Witch Trial. And if any of you are from Paisley, you know them very well. I became acquainted with them when I was doing a performance off Broadway called Sleep No More, and Sleep No More incorporates some of the Paisley Witches in the show. So when I was reading about them, I was very fascinated, not only by their story, but that I had never heard of them before, because it's a truly remarkable story. And I attributed that to the fact that they were women, and women's stories rarely get told, especially in history. And so I decided to write a screenplay about it. I thought it would make a very compelling film. And as Claire said, it has won quite a lot of awards, and I reached out to an organization in Paisley called the Renfrewshire Witch Hunt Trust online, and I became friends with them, and they helped me with a lot of research and pointed me in directions who I should talk to in terms of libraries and institutions. And in my research, I discovered there was a connection between the persecution of these women and men, but also the persecution of Blacks in the way of the transatlantic slave trade, that there is an actual connection there with the Paisley Witches. So what I thought was going to be a story about the historical persecution of women through witch trials actually became a much bigger story about the intersectionality of gender, racial, and socioeconomic inequalities. And that is the message that I'm hoping to accomplish by telling this story. So I just would like to say the names of the Paisley Witches. There were 8 people who were accused and tried of witchcraft. They were Margaret Lang, Catherine Campbell, Agnes Naismith, Margaret Fulton, John Lindsay at Barlock, John Reed, John Lindsay, and James Lindsay, who were brothers. And 7 of them were garrotted and burned at the stake. John Reed hung himself in his cell before he could be executed. And let's see. So I made a trip to Scotland to further my research, and I met the ladies who run the Renfrewshire Witch Hunt Trust, and we've become great friends. And I was planning another trip to Scotland in 2020, but of course the pandemic happened and everything shut down. So I'm hoping to make it back there in this year, once everything opens up again, and do some more research on this. So yes, I think one thing, it's important to tell the story of the witches and the, all of the people that were accused and executed for witchcraft. If you think about it, over 2,700 people were executed for witchcraft in Scotland. That's almost the same number of people who died in the Twin Towers on 9/11. And not only is there a memorial, but there's a museum dedicated to those people that were lost that day. But that was just in one day. So when you have that many people killed over 200 years, you know, it's important to remember them, because unless we're willing to tell all of our shared histories, then we as a society cannot advance. I mean, it's always going to be holding us back. So it is important to say the names, to say what happened to these people was wrong and what they did was not criminal. And for that, they should be exonerated. And that is one goal that I have. I hope that this film, when it's made, will start a conversation about that, about all of our shared histories, so that we can look back and say, yes, this was wrong, and we owe them an apology and a memorial. And I think a museum would be wonderful.
Yeah, just we'd like, that'd be very interesting.
All of these witches, the stories of all of these people, over 4,000 people, to put it all in one place that people can go and see the volume of the miscarriage of justice would be very powerful.
Yeah, thanks so much, Julia. We really appreciate you joining us today.
I'll see you tomorrow, Julia. Tickets,
yes, I am tomorrow. I'm not reading any. It was too short notice to put a reading together, but I'm possibly going to be having that on the anniversary of the Paisley Witch execution, which is in June 10th.
Great. Well, thanks everybody for joining us today. Sarah Sheridan, thank you so much for coming and for giving us the books to give out as our prizes. It's very exciting. Claire, thanks as ever for your presence.
Thank you as ever for your presence, Zoe.
And are we now going to go to, have we got a video?
Yeah, what I would just like to say, first of all, Sarah, I would just like to say thank you so much for giving up your time. You're so generous with us.
It's always lovely to chat to you guys.
You're so generous. So generous with your time and also the books. Those will be winging their way off. Everybody, I would say, get this book. Do you know, it's a fantastic book for, you don't need to start at the beginning and go through to the end. You can just pick it up and open it any page. One of my favourite bits are Sarah's Museums of Misogyny, yeah, which she puts at different points. It's a brilliant book. And I was saying this to people long before I'd actually met Sarah for the first time. And then I met Sarah and she's even more brilliant than the book. But I would also like to say a huge thank you to Julia for coming along and speaking to us today. There are tickets still available for the event in Paisley tomorrow if you look for Renfrewshire Trust. And Julia will be speaking at that again in some more detail. And now we have an absolute treat for you just to end this, which is the beautiful poem by Lenny Soris, which is called In Memoriam.
In Memoriam. They tried to tack your spirit hen, destroy that which they couldn't control. So you spoke and the world didn't listen hen, smooth the smedum that burned in your soul. Your deed, but never gone hen. There's them that still carry your name. There's them that mind criminals biding in courts, heeds that should hang heavy with shame. Old Nick didn't ken ye for Eve hen. You had but your ain eyes to see. The wrang was nae yours, the guilt was misplaced, your innocence plain as can be. But they took muckle mair than a life hen, a Connell snuffed out in its prime. A state sanctioned murder of innocent folks, punishment lacking a crime. Your soul's now at peace with the earth hen, sleep and be one with the sky. We'll scrieve your name in books they canny burn, write a legacy never to die. But we will only just beg of your pardon hen, those days have long ceased to exist. We now demand justice for all those like you, long gone, but eternally missed.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.